On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're working through the bills and the politics, taking developments one at a time, starting with a bill unveiled Thursday that would require background checks for most private gun sales. What policies do you think we should have to address the threat of mass shootings or gun violence? Do you think the governor should call a special legislative session around gun violence? Do you support or oppose red flag laws that would empower courts to take guns away from potentially dangerous people? Join in, 800-642-1234. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol reporter. She co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Take us back to Thursday, then, when Democratic lawmakers and Governor Evers unveiled this new gun legislation. What policy is he announcing there?
So this is a policy that people who have been following the gun debate in Wisconsin and across the country are probably pretty familiar with. It's called the universal background check proposal. So basically what this would do in Wisconsin, because it does vary from state to state depending on what laws are on the books right now, it would institute background checks for gun sales online, so if you buy a gun online, or at a gun show. Right now, those sales are not subject to background checks. Now, there are a couple exceptions that are written into the law. One is if you inherit a gun from a family member, that would not require a background check, or if you're gifted a gun from a family member. And then another one that, again, we hear about a lot, an exception for antique weapons. So if a weapon is deemed an antique, it has to get an official government certification as an antique. You don't need to get a background check to, you know, exchange that commercially.
And so it would probably be a certain age, you know, to designate even whether it's an antique or not.
Right. I know the government has certain criteria that that gun would have to meet in order for it to be, you know, deemed an antique.
And so the governor also is supporting red flag laws. And we've been hearing a lot straight across the country about implementing red flag laws. Can you tell us what they are?
Mm-hmm. So red flag laws became a much more popular push across the country in the wake of the Parkland, Florida shooting in 2018. Basically, what these do is they allow individuals to petition a judge to temporarily take away an individual's right to have a firearm. So what it's intended to do is allow people, you know, friends, family members, acquaintances, to sort of flag someone, if you will, hence the name red flag law, as maybe potentially dangerous to themselves, potentially dangerous to others. They go before a judge. A judge deems whether or not that flagging is appropriate. And then the rights to either buy a weapon or possess a weapon are temporarily taken away from that individual.
So what is Governor Evers considering on that front, red flag law front?
So the red flag law, kind of like the universal background check bill, has been around for a while in Wisconsin politics. The red flag law bill is being proposed by a representative from Madison, Representative Melissa Sargent. And, you know, kind of the package of these two bills are things that Governor Evers is considering calling a special session of the state legislature to consider. We know Governor Walker did this several times, calling a special session. It's a way for the executive to kind of compel lawmakers to come into the Capitol when they're not regularly scheduled to do so, to take up something that the governor thinks is particularly important.
And Governor Walker called a session after Parkland, and that's where we saw additional high school security. Is that right?
Exactly. So when Governor Walker called a special session on gun safety, gun violence, kind of a reaction to that Parkland shooting, that's when lawmakers ended up taking up this $100 million grant program that allows schools across Wisconsin to apply for grants to do things like, you know, put locks on classroom doors, put bulletproof glass around entrances to the building. There was some controversy around that time about whether those funds could be used for armed guards in schools. You are not able to apply to fund armed guards. So it's more kind of facilities improvements.
Infrastructure type
infrastructure,
things.
Exactly. And there has been some discussion in the past couple weeks about putting more money into that fund and sort of beefing up or continuing to beef up security at these so-called soft targets.
Talking with Laurel White, she's WPR State Capitol reporter. She's guiding us through this edition of the State Capitol Report. Where do you come down on universal background checks and red flag laws? What steps do you want to see on gun legislation in Wisconsin? What questions do you have about the bills? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Laurel, what did Governor Evers and Democratic lawmakers say is the purpose of this gun legislation? Why do they think it's necessary right now?
So again, this is something that Democratic lawmakers have really been pushing for a while. During that last special session that Governor Walker called in 2018, Democratic lawmakers actually used a procedural move to try to bring up universal background checks on the floor. So these are proposals that they have been arguing in favor of for a long time. They say that they're going to make it more difficult for people who shouldn't have weapons to get those weapons. That was a big part of the press conference, actually, last week. There was the police chief from Middleton. You might remember the shooting at a software company in Middleton. Yeah. And he spoke at the press conference and talked about the shooter in that instance getting a weapon without passing a background check. So he said that that's a very specific example of someone who, you know, wouldn't have been able to get a gun legally if this law were to have passed.
Let's bring in George now, joining us from Mount Horeb. Hi, George.
This is Charles.
I'm sorry, Charles.
That's fine. We really need to look at what solutions we're proposing and see if they'll solve the problem they're trying to solve. We just can't pass laws to pass laws. I know you said the one guy may have not have passed a background check and gotten a gun legally in Middleton. The Chicago has very strict background laws, and they have a very high gun incident occurrences. And we just can't keep trying to pass laws to say we did something.
Yeah,
it's
so
not helped.
Charles, right? I think what I hear from you saying is that, you know, even these laws may not go, you know, hit the core of the problem,
mm-hmm.
Laurel.
And that's a big part of the debate. Absolutely. Republican lawmakers have kind of pushed back in the wake of the governor rolling out the background check proposal in particular, saying that they don't believe it's accurate to say that increasing background checks will prevent particularly mass shootings. They say it's disingenuous and there isn't really a connection there. Instead, Republican leaders in the assembly have been kind of pivoting to conversations about mental health and increasing funding for mental health programs in Wisconsin. They say that's a big part of the problem. They also have talked about increasing funding for security around those soft targets that we were talking about before. So sending more money to schools to do security improvements, buildings like the state capitol, other state buildings, making sure they have the infrastructure they need.
Are Democratic lawmakers, are they okay when they hear that this is a mental health issue? Are they pushing back against that?
I think what we've heard from Democratic lawmakers is, yes, we need more mental health funding, but they certainly are pushing very strongly for these increased regulations of guns as well. Like I said, you know, they've been pushing for the universal background check bill for quite a while. Red flag laws, they've been pushing for that for a while. So they really believe that these are the solutions to the problems, or at least steps that you can take to help. I think the argument there isn't that any of these single proposals are going to completely prevent something, but they're going to put up additional barriers that will make it more difficult for people that shouldn't have guns.
We're talking with WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White about the debate over gun control. Democrats are calling for expanded background checks, as we've heard, red flag laws that would take away firearms from people who are perceived as dangerous. Republican lawmakers aren't convinced this legislation would move the needle on gun violence. Do you think the governor should call a special legislative session on this? Do you support or oppose red flag laws? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap on the Ideas Network. We're looking at all sides of the debate over gun control and proposals that surfaced at the Capitol. It is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says it's unlikely the legislature will take up a red flag law. Here he is on WISN radio last week.
The idea of a red flag law basically says that we're going to take people's constitutional rights away from them before they commit a crime because they could. Well, that is a fundamental principle for many of us that just is very difficult to get around.
Do you support or oppose red flag laws that would empower courts to take guns away from potentially dangerous people? What policies would address gun violence? Is there a bipartisan solution here? Join in at 800-642-1234. WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White stays with us. Let's go to Wendy now, joining us from Waukesha. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I have been so frustrated that it has taken us so long to get to this point where we're finally trying to get some legislation through. My sister was killed by her husband because he could go to a gun show. He went to a gun show and bought a gun. He was a convicted felon. He should never have had a gun. And the sad thing is there was no recourse for the children who were left behind. There was nobody who was responsible for that man getting a gun. Are we ever going to get this passed?
Wendy, thanks for sharing your story, and sorry for your loss. Laurel, what are the chances of seeing this policy move forward? Because it's been there in the past.
It has been there in the past, and this is something that Republican lawmakers have been pretty consistent in their opposition to. So I think it would have to be a pretty big swing for Republican state lawmakers to approve this. And Republicans do have sizable majorities in the state legislature right now. So I think it would require a pretty seismic shift in kind of the political makeup of the state for the universal background check bill to move forward at this point.
Do we know how Wisconsin lawmakers view gun control policy against the backdrop of the mass shootings?
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a conversation that has been happening consistently in Wisconsin over the past several years, you know, and we kind of see the same points emerging. I remember when Governor Walker was in office going to ask him what he was going to do as the governor about mass shootings. Actually went to Governor Evers in the same location at the same event to ask him this year. So it does seem like it's a bit of a cyclical debate in terms of Republican state lawmakers saying we don't want to infringe on Second Amendment rights. We don't want to infringe on due process. You heard Speaker Voss speaking to that in the clip that we started out this segment on. And Democratic lawmakers saying that we need to have some reasonable limits in place, in their words, reasonable, to make sure that people who shouldn't have guns from having them.
Let's go to Bill now in Marinette County. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I was just wondering about the, first of all, the gun show gun checks. There are background checks at gun shows. You buy a gun from a dealer at a gun show. If it falls under the background check, like a handgun, I think now in Wisconsin, they do a background check. So at gun shows, they're not only private sales between individuals who aren't dealers, like me and, say, I go to a gun show and there's another guy there and he's got something to sell. That's a private sale. So when you want to do away with those and you use the gun show as an example, that also means that other private sales would be affected. But the red flag law, I'm curious, the person being flagged, would they know who made the call, or would that be done anonymously?
That's a really interesting question, Bill. Thank you.
That is a good question and one I don't know the answer to. We could definitely look into that. That might be something that's prescribed in the legislation right now, and it might not be. I mean, that kind of specification is something that sometimes we see added during the process of debating a bill, and this bill hasn't gotten too far in the legislative process as it's been introduced in the past. It hasn't had hearings, either public hearings where people come in and testify, or executive sessions where lawmakers kind of start the voting process. So that could be something that's in there now. I'm not entirely sure. And I think it is important to point out that there are background checks at some sales, for some sales at gun shows. As Bill said, if you are a federally licensed dealer, you do have to put out a background check, and the buyer does have to pass that. But for private sales that do occur at gun shows and, of course, outside of gun shows, right now there's no background check in place, and the governor's proposal would do that.
Let's bring in John now in Somerset. Hi, John.
Hi. Yes, hi. I was going to say about the red flag laws. I think they're, you know, there's no due process there. They're guilty till proven innocent. So they're kind of ineffective.
So you would not support a red flag law, John?
No, because there's no due process. It's like you're guilty till proven innocent.
John,
and you got to go through a long process to prove your innocence and a lot of time and money.
John, thanks so much. Have you heard that from lawmakers, Laurel?
Absolutely. I think that's really the primary argument against the red flag law from, you know, we've heard that from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and from Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. So sort of the two primary leaders in the state legislature right now have really given voice to that argument pretty consistently.
Early last week, Capitol reporters had been gathering comments from the lawmakers on gun policy as the national discussion also ramped up. What did we hear from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle? Is there consensus?
Well, I think there is a certain amount of consensus on either side of the aisle. We're not seeing a lot of crossover consensus in terms of bipartisan cooperation on the issue quite yet. I think a big part of the debate last week was Republican lawmakers saying they weren't quite ready to comment on specific proposals because there hadn't been bills officially rolled out yet. And so when Governor Evers had his press conference late last week with, you know, more than a dozen Democratic lawmakers, he said Republicans haven't been willing to go public on their proposals on some of these or on their positions on some of these proposals because there hasn't been a bill to look at. Well, now we have a bill for them to look at. So I think what the governor is pushing for now is really every legislator in the legislature to have a public opinion on each of these bills, because what we've heard from some Republicans predominantly for a big part of last week was, I just can't comment at this point.
Let's bring in another call, Jeremy in Racine. Hi, Jeremy. Oh, and Jeremy is not there. Steve, are you there in Sun Prairie? Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, I think when you look at gun violence, you have to look at where it's coming from. And, you know, most gun violence happens with suicide, which, you know, requires one type of prescription. We have gang violence, which is another type of prescription. And the two that think that are right.
Oh, and Steve, I think you're dropping as well, having some difficulty with connections. Steve asking, how much is suicide versus mass shootings versus homicide as we look at the policies and the legislation that is getting off the ground here?
So we know that suicide is a very large percentage of the overall gun violence epidemic in Wisconsin. So that's something that gun policy experts have really been pointing to as different proposals are rolled out, sort of what role can these play in preventing suicide as well. That's interestingly a big part of the red flag law discussion, actually. Some people who have studied different gun policies across the country say that red flag laws have played an important role in reducing suicide in states where they have been put in place. So I think certainly the different types of gun violence, whether it's self-inflicted or on others, is a big part of the conversation. And that's why you'll hear when people talk about red flag laws, if that person is flagged as a danger to themselves or to others, they'll have the gun potentially taken away.
So what are you watching for next on gun policy? Because this is a debate that, you know, has had a long, long history in Wisconsin and mm-hmm. elsewhere across the country.
I think the next big thing that we have our eye on is just whether or not Governor Evers is going to call that special session on gun violence. He said that's something that he's still certainly considering. And then if he does go ahead and call that special session, what legislation are lawmakers going to take up? Because there's no requirement that they have to take up the proposals that the governor thinks are particular priorities. They just have to take it up within a certain subject matter. So the Republicans that control the state legislature could say, all right, Governor, you've called us in for a special session on guns. We're going to pass more mental health measures. We're going to pass more security measures. So if this moves forward, I think it's going to be interesting to see what lawmakers end up debating on the floor if they are called in.
Well, Laurel, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol reporter, and she co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with a look at several bills that would affect tuition and fees at state universities for years to come. We have a higher education reporter here with details right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. College affordability remains a hot topic as students head back to campuses this fall. We're talking about it on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's look at several bills now authored by Republicans and Democrats that would shake up major revenue streams for state universities. UW System President Ray Cross is urging lawmakers to end the tuition freeze for resident undergrads that started in 2013.
Well, it isn't just that we're seeking to increase tuition. We're seeking an increased investment, whatever form that takes. We cannot maintain quality without sufficient investment in the university.
And that was Ray Cross earlier this month on WPT's Here and Now. What do you think about the UW tuition freeze? Should it continue or come to an end? How should lawmakers be addressing college affordability? Join in at 800-642-1234. Kelly Meyerhofer is the higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Kelly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So we saw a number of bills this summer addressing higher ed. And let's start with a proposal from Representative Dave Murphy and Senator Andre Jacques that would capture future tuition increases at the rate of inflation. And we had Senator Jacques on our program earlier this month talking about his student days at UW-Madison.
I was there during the years where you saw significant double-digit tuition increases, and tuition was seen as an escape valve for not making some of the same difficult choices that other levels of government made.
So, Kelly, UW system leaders have opposed past tuition freezes without additional state funding. How are they responding to this new idea of future tuition hikes capped at inflation?
Well, I think the bill, you know, they like that this bill gives some specificity to how the tuition freeze would be lifted. But the bill that Dave Murphy has proposed, it locks in the tuition rate that a student pays in his or her first year for the next 3 years. So it's essentially another sort of tuition freeze for each incoming class. And I don't know if the system, you know, it restricts their flexibility a lot. And so they haven't said whether they support the bill or not.
And how does it lock in? Because isn't it like 3 years where you would have to be set at a specific tuition rate? Or how does that work?
Yeah, so when a student enters a UW campus, the tuition freeze or the tuition price that is applied to them in that year it applies for the next 3 years. So it's, you know, a four-year college career, and that's the price that they would pay.
Could that have an even greater effect on keeping tuition rates down, you know, because any increase would not affect most students?
Correct. I mean, the only increases that the UW System Board of Regents could have is, you know, raising it to inflation, and that would only apply to the next incoming class.
And we heard Senator Jacques reference double-digit tuition increases during his campus days in the early 2000s. If we didn't have the current tuition freeze, what limits exist on how much universities could increase tuition any given year?
That's a good question. I'm not aware of any sort of limits if there weren't a tuition freeze, which is why the lawmakers put it in to try to keep affordability, you know, available for students.
What do system leaders say the issue is with keeping a tuition freeze in place? What have we heard from Ray Cross?
It really limits their flexibility, especially when you couple that with the decline in state money that they've received. The Fiscal Bureau said earlier this summer the system's been cut by about $1.1 billion since 2011. And, you know, with the tuition freeze in place for the past 6 years, that's about $200 million that they could have received in inflation-level tuition increases.
So this summer, Democrats proposed different bills that would give the UW system more funding to offset tuition freezes. Have Democrats explained how long they want to freeze tuition and how much that could cost taxpayers?
Yeah, Democrats' stance seems to be that they want to keep the tuition freeze in place. They recognize that both faculty, students, families, they like the tuition freeze. It keeps affordability in place. But what they're really seeking to do is what they call fully fund the tuition freeze by giving the state more aid money to offset the money that the system is losing from the freeze.
And how would that aid be given out? Like what would we see there?
I think that would really be up to lawmakers how they would want to fund that. I mean, I think Democrats really like giving the system a lot of flexibility, so I think they would give them the money and say the system knows how to spend their money best, and they would, you know, let them spend it how they see fit.
We're talking about some bills this year that could affect tuition and fees at UW system schools. Our guide is Kelly Meyerhofer with the Wisconsin State Journal. She covers higher ed. How do you think state authorities could be cutting college costs? What should the state's colleges be doing? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Kelly, are there any lawmakers talking about cutting tuition rates or making it free to attend publicly funded colleges like in other states?
I haven't heard that become part of the conversation yet. I mean, I know it's part of the national conversation with presidential candidates, but I haven't heard any state lawmakers talk about that yet. That's a good question, though.
In terms of Democrats and Republicans coming together on the issue of a tuition freeze, do you see them, you know, are they on the same page about anything? Do you see any type of overlap where they have a vision on this?
I think the fact that both Republicans and Democrats have introduced bills related to the tuition freeze speaks to a sort of recognition that, you know, the tuition freeze will now be in place for 8 years. It'll be in place for this next year and the next year after that. So I think the fact that they're talking about, you know, paving some sort of way, starting some sort of conversation about it speaks to that.
We have divided government with a Republican-controlled legislature, Governor Evers. Governor, does there seem to be any way that the two can work together and come to a consensus on tuition rates?
I mean, I think the fact that Governor Evers proposed putting more money in his budget proposal to give to the system so that that they would have money to make up for the freeze, I think Republicans seemed interested in that, but just not as much money as Governor Evers would have wanted.
Well, let's look. This summer, Representative Dave Murphy and Senator Andre Jacques introduced legislation that would ban fee-funded building projects in the UW unless a majority of students voted twice in support of higher fees. So can you take a step back here? How can students currently increase their fees for building projects?
Well, currently, only a majority of all students who participate in one referendum are required for approval of the fees that are used for different amenities on campus, such as student unions, recreation facilities. Dorms are separate from that. What students pay to live in dorms, that money goes to build and renovate new dorms. So we're talking specifically just about like student unions, sports rec centers, how those are funded. It comes from a variety of different revenue sources, but a major one is referendums on campus.
So these referendums on campus, how do they work typically?
Usually, like, student government works with the university to say, you know what, we need a new student union. Ours is falling apart. So they decide to hold an election. And if they get a majority of the students voting in that election to say, yes, I want to increase my student fees by X amount, then they have that money and lawmakers sign on and then they can have the money to build the new student union or whatever they're after.
And how many students typically participate in these fee referendums?
Turnout's usually pretty low. I mean, the highest that I heard of was at UW-Madison several years ago. They signed on, about a third of campus voted in a 2014 referendum to upgrade their rec facilities.
So what new challenges would the proposed legislation add for fee increases?
Well, I mean, the student leaders that I've talked to say it would pretty much be impossible to get a majority of all students to campus voting in a campus election and approving a fee increase. So, I mean, they say that it would make it virtually impossible to pass anything.
So basically, this legislation could effectively block all fee increases because of low participation?
Fee increases that relate to these buildings. There are some different fees that the university can raise for other things that students don't have control over, but for this, yes.
So we're basically, you know, the issue with capital improvements and building changes, building upgrades, that would be severely compromised under a fee structure.
Correct.
So how important are student fees for building projects?
Well, I mean, when you look at how much fees have increased over the past couple years, you know, the universities have relied on them more than I think they have in the past before the tuition freeze began. You know, it's important to note the tuition freeze funds more like academic and operating costs, and this is capital projects. So it's a little bit separate, but fees have increased. I mean, since 2013, when the freeze began at UW-Madison, fees have increased about 28%.
28%. So that's quite a hike.
Yeah, I mean, 28%. It's substantial. It is worth noting the fees in general. I mean, it was like around $1,100 in 2013. At UW-Madison, students are going to be paying closer to, I think, $1,400.
And is that replicated around the UW? Do you see fee hikes happening at other campuses?
Yeah, I mean, year to year, you know, there's always a few campuses that don't have projects going on, so they don't need to increase it. But the general trend across the UW campuses is that fees are going up.
We're talking about bills that would affect tuition and fees at state universities for years to come. Kelly Meyerhofer stays with us. She's the higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. How does the cost of tuition or student fees affect your life? Are you a college student, a parent, or a teacher? What issues in higher ed do you think policymakers should be talking about? Do you support the state's tuition freeze at UW system schools? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back with this in just a minute. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're looking at legislation that would affect higher ed on this edition of the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We've been talking about segregated fees, these charges in addition to tuition assessed to all students for things like student services and activities and programs and building facilities that support the mission of the UW. A Republican bill aims to put a check on what segregated fees can be used for at the UW campuses, and the fees proposal is one of a series of bills aimed at issues across the UW system under a Republican package is called Open and Accessible UW. So should the state require a higher threshold before students can approve fee increases? Join in at 800-642-1234. Kelly Meyerhofer is the higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and she stays with us. Kelly, another issue that you've recently been covering is, you know, state agencies that oversee for-profit colleges. Lawmakers moved the agency under the umbrella of another agency a couple years ago. Can you refresh what's going on there?
Sure. There used to be an independent board that oversaw Wisconsin's for-profit colleges, and in September 2017, the Republican-controlled legislature and former Governor Scott Walker decided to shift oversight to within a state agency, and their reason for that was that it would decrease the regulatory and fiscal burden on for-profit schools. So I decided to check in, you know, roughly 2 years since this happened, and what I found is that the agency overseeing for-profit colleges now is sort of building up its watchdog role after this transition. There was a lot of experienced employees with expertise in this topic that left or were not invited to join the state agency. There was prolonged vacancies, and they had no spending authority to fill those positions.
And this is the Educational Approval Board?
Correct. It's called it was the Educational Approval Board. It's now part of the Department of Safety and Professional Services.
So the Walker administration said that during the transition that the same number of employees would be employed under the DSPS and assume all responsibilities the board previously oversaw. Is that what you found in your reporting?
I think that their spending authority was limited. They had about four employees, and they couldn't fill those vacancies to bring them back up to the number that they were promised to have. And just one of those four employees previously worked for the board.
Is there less need for the watchdog agency today since so many for-profit schools have been closed?
That's true. I mean, under the Obama administration, there was a lot of federal scrutiny over these colleges, and a lot of them did close. And the economy is also doing pretty strongly right now. But the worry is, you know, these are kind of cyclical. And as soon as you hit a recession, there's a lot of for-profit colleges that open to try to provide people with new training to get them new jobs. So there's some concern from lawmakers about, you know, are we equipped to be in the right place for when a recession does hit and these colleges come back?
Let's take a call now. Barb joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Barb.
Hi, this is a great discussion, and I want to just add something to the mix, which could be a good story for WPR or the reporter who's on for her newspaper. My comment is that I graduated from UW-Stout in 1980. I had a college debt of $1,200 from student loans. My tuition was about $500 a semester. And I was, at that time, we benefited from the fact that the state was paying a larger proportion of a student's, the cost of tuition for a student. So I'm interested in knowing what that percentage has risen to, where the student is responsible, and where that money was diverted to. Because when I graduated, I paid $75 a quarter for 10 years. I had a great way to start out a life after college. And the students coming out of even our public colleges have just a ridiculous amount of student loan debt. You know, how can they prepare for the next stage of their life? So back to the original question, what is the percentage that the state paid in 1980 versus what the state pays today per student in the UW system?
Yeah, Barb, thank you so much. And Barb really wants to look at the history here, the historical impact of student debt. And what have we seen on that? How has it changed?
I think from the 1970s, the state was funding roughly 40% of the cost of the UW system's budget. I think with the current budget passed earlier this summer, it's around 14 or 15%. The UW system has really tried to diversify, you know, sources of revenue coming in. They get a lot more federal money through grants and stuff like that. But it has made them more reliant on tuition, which is why tuition increased a lot in the early 2000s. And now you have a tuition freeze in place. So that's, it sort of speaks to the limited flexibility that the system has.
Yeah, Barb, thank you so much for the call. And Kelly, you've also been looking at campus emergency phones. You recently explored how often they're used at UW-Madison. You found that people rarely use them for actual emergencies. What's going on there?
Yeah, so I was curious about the, there's these blue lights on campus. You may see them in parking garages or somewhere around campus. Students or faculty or staff can press them and the police come. But with cell phones nowadays, they're vastly underused. But they're still, you know, a cost to operate and maintain for campuses. So the discussion sort of nationally in colleges across the country is looking at, should we get rid of them? I mean, and save some money? Should we keep them? What I found in my reporting is students recognize, you know, they don't really use these lights at all, but they like having them around there just in case.
So you found how many, how many calls do they get from these lights?
In 2018 on UW-Madison's campus, when you take out all the prank calls and the missed dials, they had 3 legitimate calls that year. None of them were an emergency. I mean, for example, one of them was someone who couldn't find their car. So,
is this the case across all UW system schools? Do all of the campuses have these blue lights?
I don't know if every single one. I didn't look at every single campus, but the majority of them do, and the majority of them are sort of confronting what to do with them. For example, at UW-La Crosse, they seem to like them. They promote them to students as something to use in non-emergencies. But then you look at, like, UW-Milwaukee, and they're sort of starting the conversation this fall about, you know, should we phase them out or should we keep them going?
Do we know how much they cost to operate?
UW-Madison wasn't able to provide me with a cost estimate for operating them. At UW-Oshkosh, they told me that it costs about $1,500 to keep the phones going each year. But the problem is a lot of universities, they're sort of converting all of their phone systems from this old technology to a digital phone line. And so they have to bring the blue light phones in line with that.
Oh, that whole VoIP conversion.
I
don't even know
VoIP.
What VoIP stands for, the acronym, if someone can help us there. But so even those phones, the blue light campus phones, have to be converted.
Yeah, they're looking to upgrade them, and that could cost a bit more. At UW-Oshkosh, they're estimating it'll be about $189,000.
So in this era where so many cell phones are out there, is this an expense? Or even taking them off a campus would be an additional expense?
That's true. I mean, that's sort of the question that all the campuses are grappling with, is what do we want to do with these?
Well, Kelly, we have just a few moments here, but looking forward as a higher education reporter, what do you have your eye on these days?
I think the tuition freeze is something that, the system's always watching. The legislatures, I think they're coming back into session in October, so that's something to watch. Students are coming back to campus in the fall, so we'll see where it goes.
So you have a busy schedule as you look to have school back in session, that there will be issues coming up once students come back.
Yeah, things definitely pick up in the fall.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Kelly Meyerhofer is the higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Just ahead, we get an update on the state's tracking of opioid-related deaths and a new opioid dashboard. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.